Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here is Bob.
I need you to follow me. I'll be going verse by verse, sometimes word by word. I hope you have a pencil tonight or get one from the few in front of you, because I'm going to give you many cross-references that relate. I've tried to write most of them in the thing I've given you. Is anybody here doesn't have an outline tonight? You'd raise your hand. Brother Bob, you got some more? Gary, they're right down here. Would you help me pass them out? I think there's some right there. And Randy, there's some right over there, I believe. Would you see if anybody in your X section needs some? Is that them? Okay. Is that them, Randy? Raise your hand then again, and we'll get these to you. Because if someone else usually comes that you know about, it's not here tonight, take one for them. Because they'll get lost if they're not somehow gotten tonight. The air conditioner's on. It'll be cool in a minute. So let's begin with chapter 7, and I think what I'm going to do tonight, instead of reading the whole thing at once, I'm going to go verse by verse through it, probably by paragraph. So let's read together verse 1 down through verse 8, if we could, please. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions in his mind as he lay on his bed. Then he wrote the dream down and related the following summary of it. Daniel said, I was looking in my vision by night, and behold, four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. And four great beasts were coming up from the sea, different one from another. And the first was like a lion that had the wings of an eagle. And I kept looking until its wings were plucked, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. A human mind was also given to it. And behold, another beast, a second one, resembling a bear. And it was raised up on one side, and had three ribs were in its mouth between its teeth. And thus they said to it, Arise, devour, eat much meat. After this I kept looking, and behold, another one, like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrifying, and exceedingly strong, and it had large iron teeth. And it devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet. And it was different from all the other beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. And while I was contemplating the horns, behold, another little horn, came up among them, and three of the first horns were pulled out by the roots of it. And behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth uttering great boast. Does this sound like your everyday historical narrative? This is a special kind of literature, isn't it? This is apocalyptic literature. Apocalyptic literature is especially expressive in the field of numbers, the imagery of animals, and all kinds of things like that. Now, in going back through this, I think the best thing for us to do is to try to take a verse at a time and speak about each of these metaphors that we can speak of, and just say we don't know when it comes to that. In the first year of Belshazzar. Now, what is the problem here? The problem is that this is not a chronological book, because Darius the Mede is in chapter 6, and that's much later than the last king that we know of Babylon. Remember the feast, the handwriting on the wall? Well, that's back in chapter 5. And so this happened, this vision happened back in chapter 5 is the setting. So this book is not chronological as far as events, and that's very important to know. It's not chronological. Now, you see in chapter 2, he had a dream, and the dream, God spoke to him about the coming kingdoms of the world, four to be specific. Now, it speaks first about the four winds of heaven. Now, please write down somewhere on the front or back of this, put number symbolism, and I'm going to begin chapter 7 on, keep this with you, bring it every Wednesday night. The different numbers, as we come to them, what their symbolism is in Jewish apocalyptic writing. The number 4 is extremely expressive of the world. And where we get that is from several things, and one of them is right here. The four winds of heaven, the four corners of the earth, the four directions of the compass. It speaks of the earth, all of the earth. Now, when the four winds of heaven are mentioned, what exactly is that speaking about? Jerome, the translator of the Latin Vulgate, which is still the official translation of the Roman Catholic Church, said that these four winds are angels. Now, I'm not sure whether they're good angels or bad angels. I simply know this, that the sea is going to represent mankind, and that the trick is it's not mankind that stirs himself up, but is a supernatural force coming from the outside that stirs up the world and the world nations and the world people. So this, at least, whether it's an angel or not, I don't know. It is a supernatural force, and it comes and it stirs up. You see the word stirring up there? This is the idea where I get the idea of the four winds stir up the nations. Now, you see the word great sea? You see the word last thing, the great sea? And then down in verse 3, it just says the sea. Now, if you're familiar with these different words I'm going to use, I talked to you about them when I introduced the book of the Revelation. One of them is called dispensationalism, and it was begun basically by a man named Larkin coming out of the Plymouth Brethren. And he sees a distinction between the great sea in verse 2 and the sea in verse 3. He sees the great sea as being the Mediterranean Sea. And it's very important for him as the Mediterranean, because most of these world empires are very close in proximity to the Mediterranean Ocean. Now, the place he gets that from is in Exodus 34, 6 and 7, and Joshua 9, 1. The phrase, the great sea, refers to the Mediterranean Ocean. I personally think that the great sea and the sea are synonymous terms, and it does not so much refer to the Mediterranean Sea as it does to all of mankind. Now, I think that I think I gave you some deals there. Scofield, in the Scofield Reference Edition, lists Matthew 13:47 and Revelation 13:1 as an expression of unorganized humanity, just a bunch of people. Now, the Broadman Commentary, which is our particular denominational commentary, sees this idea of the great sea and the sea as going back to Genesis 1:21, where it speaks of the fact of God. Spirit brooded over the waters, and they would understand the waters here. Now, whenever you hear somebody who is talking from an academic background use the word myth, they're not using the word myth the way you use the word myth. The word myth in common everyday English means a made-up story, a fairy tale. Myth, to someone who's trained in theology, speaks about using certain metaphors to describe creation, and they would be metaphors like chaos, and that God somehow came into chaos and made it orderly. Now, that's Greek philosophy. That's not biblical theology. Biblical theology says there wasn't chaos and God made it, put a structure on it. The Bible says there was nothing and God spoke and there was everything. So this is really, to me, it's much more Babylonian. You've heard of the Babylonian creation epic? That's mostly what they're referring to. I really don't think I buy that much, but they have some verses they want you to look at that you can see that some of this kind of talk about Leviathan, the great sea monster, and all that is in the Bible. Please take these down. You may have them there. Let me look. Yeah, you've got most of them there. This Isaiah 51:10, Amos 7:4, Psalm 36:6. Look at those when you get home, okay? Now, you see when it says the four great beasts were coming up. Now, here's the question I want to ask you. It's going to be very important in our understanding of interpreting this chapter. Are the four beasts simultaneous? Are the four beasts successive? Are these world empires that come one after another in chronological order? Are they four empires that occur simultaneously in the world? Now, it seems here, at least in verse 3, that what we have is four great beasts coming up at one time. It seems here to be simultaneous. I think only later do we see that this will not fit at all the interpretation of the chapter, but we've got to make them successive kingdoms, like I talked to you a couple of weeks ago about Babylon, Medo-Persian, Greek, and Roman, successive, one after another. Now, you see where it says different from one another? If you'll remember back in chapter 2, we had the huge image of a statue with different kinds of metals describing the different kingdoms. Nebuchadnezzar was the head of gold. We knew that much. There was the chest and the arms of silver, or was it bronze? I forgot. I think it's silver. And the middle section was bronze, and the bottom part was clay and iron. Remember? Now, chapter 2 is a direct parallel to chapter 7. Chapter 2 talks about four successive world empires. Chapter 7 is the same exact four world empires from a different view. Number chapter 2 looked as man would see these empires. There was the head of gold, and it was had majesty and power. And remember all that, the big tree that covered all the earth? Looking at the kingdoms from man's points of view. Chapter 7 is going to look at the same kingdoms from God's point of view. And in God's point of view, what man thought was so powerful and majestic and royal, from God's point of view, is wild beasts devouring one another. Now, you see where it talks about in verse 4, one was like a lion with the wings of an eagle. Now, have any of you ever seen pictures of Babylon recreated, maybe in National Geographic, the Smithsonian, something like that? Pictures of some of the gates of the city of Babylon. Have you ever seen one of those? They have a picture of a lion with wings. You ever seen that one? The lion with wings? It was the symbol of Babylon. It was on every gate that went into the city, protected the city. Now, it's very appropriate to me that this was written by a man in Daniel's day and not written later, because if it was written in the Maccabean day, they did not know what the symbols of Babylon were. It's very appropriate that the lion with wings represents the Babylon Empire. It's exactly their historical symbol. Now, notice about this creature. He was lifted up. His wings were plucked. He was lifted up from the ground, made to stand on 2 feet, and a human mind was put in him. Now, what does that, those of you who've been here every night in the study of Daniel, what does that remind you of? Something happened to him physically. His mind was changed. What does that sound like? Nebuchadnezzar's deal, right? His heart was changed to a beast heart for so many. Now, I think we decided that night that the time sequence there was not so much a definite period of months and weeks and years, but it was an indefinite period of time, right? 7 kind of epochs of time, whether seasons or years or lunar months, we don't know. So, this is referring, I believe, to Nebuchadnezzar, the fact that he had a human heart given back to him after he had this beast heart. And that's the only reference I can possibly understand to this kind of thing. Now, in verse 5, it talks about the second beast. And the second beast is the symbol of a bear. And notice what it looks like. It's raised up on one side. Now, in my mind, when I kept reading, raised up on one side, I kind of thought in my mind it was laying on one side. You know what I mean? Just laying down on one side. But I think better, probably what it means is, have you ever seen a picture of a deer where the front paw would be up and out and the other one would be too, like it was running, and the other one would be back? I think probably better when it says leaning on one side is referring to a snapshot picture of a bear running, where one foot's on the ground this side and one foot's on the ground this side, but the other side is up in the air like walking. Now, some think this refers to, and I think absolutely true, this is a reference, I believe, to the Medo-Persian Empire. And if there was an unbalanced power structure, Persia was much more aggressive, much more dominant than was the Media Empire. And therefore, that the side that was laying down is the Media, and the side that's aggressive is the Persian. But remember, you just can't read too much into this, okay? I'm not really sure Daniel meant every little hair on the bear's head to symbolize something. So don't make it say too much. Don't make it say too little, okay? Now we've got this bear. He's got 3 ribs in his mouth. Beautiful picture. What is the idea of 3 ribs being in a bear's mouth? What could that possibly be? Well, as you look back in the historical context of the Bible, as you try to somehow ferret all this out, you find that in the 8th chapter, the 20th verse, it's going to speak about the directions which the Medo-Persian Empire conquered. And it's going to talk about north and south and, I believe, west. Now, if you take north, south, and west as referring to the ribs in the mouth of the bear in this chapter, it would refer the west being Babylon, the south being Egypt, and the north being Asia Minor, or the country they call Lydia, the country of Lydia. Now that's a possible interpretation. Many people believe that there's no symbolic meaning in these 3 ribs. It's simply a way of showing the very aggressiveness of the bear. And the command is to devour much meat. Arise, devour much meat. Some folks see no symbolism at all in the 3 ribs. Some do see this directional kind of symbolism, that this empire went in 3 directions, basically, north, south, and west. I really don't know. It gets a little deep there. Now, you notice then in verse 6, where it talks about the 4 wings of the bird. I want you to notice it's 4 wings, not of an eagle like the first beast, but of a regular bird. Now, the 4 wings is going to speak of swiftness. It's going to speak of somebody who conquers quickly and really conquers a lot. Now, who would that be? Very fast kind of conqueror. Who? Alexander the Great. He was very young when he started. In 11 years, he conquered the whole world and died at 33. Isn't that amazing? Died at 33. Now, the wings, notice the four heads. Now, the commentators really have a fight over this because they say everywhere in Daniel that's talking about kings or kingdoms, it uses the symbol of the horn. Now, can you tell me why that's not accurate? I just made a statement. Everywhere in Daniel, some say that when you're going to symbolize a king, you always use the symbol of a horn on some kind of animal. What have we studied that tells you that can't be accurate, at least 100%? What other image or something did we study where the head represented something? The image. The image in chapter 2. The head of that image was gold, and the head represented who? Nebuchadnezzar. Therefore, that is a false statement to say that heads never in Daniel represent kingdoms. It does in chapter 2:39. So therefore, the heads here, now here's where the fight gets in. We're going to, right here. Those who do not believe in predictive prophecy and do not believe that Daniel could have written this ahead of time, though it was written by somebody looking back on history, they'll make the first kingdom, they'll make it Babylon, they'll make the second kingdom, Median or Media, they'll make the third one, Persia, and they'll make the fourth one, Greece, because the writing is supposed to be done in the Maccabean period, which is the Grecian period, 165 B.C., and the writer is writing back, you see. And so they'll make the four heads part, not of the Alexander, the Greek Empire, but the Persian Empire. They'll say, see, heads can't represent a king. But I think heads do represent a king. And why would four heads be so important in Alexander the Great's country? After he died, how many generals took over his power? And I'll give those names to you. You can write them down. It might be interesting to you. The Greek general, or the general in Egypt is called Ptolemy. You've heard of him. The general in Macedonia was called Philip. The general in Babylon and Syria was called Seleucus. And the general in Thrace was called Lysimachus. Now, I think these four heads, and I think this pretty well knocks it down to me, that the Grecian is the third empire, was these four generals into which the empire of Alexander the Great was divided. Now, notice it talks about, one other interpretation while I'm here, because I want to give you all that if I can. Some say this four heads is the same kind of thing as the four winds back up in verse 2, which speaks not so much of angels, or not so much of kings, or not so much of kingdoms, but speaks of the four corners of the earth, or the universal idea. Therefore, they would understand this thing, and also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. They would say the four heads represent universal dominion given to Alexander, and has nothing to do with the four generals. Do you see how quickly and how ambiguous this language is? When you start saying what you know what this symbol means, or you know what this symbol means, you just can't say that you have definite biblical authority for saying the four heads mean. You see what I'm saying? We can theorize, and we can postulate, and we can kind of try to work it out, but in the end we've got to say we can't be as dogmatic with passages like this as we can with John 3:16. 1 Corinthians 13, and stuff like that. Genesis 1. This kind of passage does not lend itself to that kind of dogmatic interpretation. Now, notice the fourth beast. And the whole point of this thing is that the fourth beast is the one that becomes very important. Daniel is going to ask about it later. Now, verse 7. Night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrifying and extremely strong. What he's saying is, there's no animal that can even be loosely compared to the power and strength and frightfulness of this fourth beast. He didn't even try to describe it. Now, you notice where it talks about has teeth of iron? Now, I think that definitely here the mention of the word iron could possibly go back to chapter 2. And that it could possibly, which I think is absolutely correct, relate this fourth empire with the Roman Empire. The empire of iron and clay. Now, many of you have bought a commentary that I suggested to you by Edward Young, right? And he says that in this fourth empire, we can see four very definite kind of stages. And I want you to watch as these stages begin. First, we have the beast, right? We have the beast that can't be described, but it's terrible looking. And then something is going to happen to this beast. What's going to happen? 10 horns are going to come out, okay? And you see the 10 horns in the last part of verse 7. Now, what could these 10 horns symbolize? Turn back over to your numbers again, the section you put for numbers. The number 10. The number 10 in Jewish apocalyptic always refers to completeness. Completeness. Fullness. Okay, now let's go back to the 10 horns. Two ways of interpreting. Some see the 10 horn as representing 10 kings. Some see the 10 horn as representing many kings without a specific number, but the number of kings being the complete number of kings in that kingdom. Now, you see what I'm saying? Some say it's a literal 10 kings. Some say it's many kings, exactly not 10, but the fullness of the number of kings in that kingdom. Now, the problem is going to be exactly who are we referring to, these 10 kings. Now, notice it says in verse 8, "And while I was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, a little one, came up among them, and three of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it." Now, you see the three successive stages? You got the beast coming out of the water, then you've got the 10 horns coming out, then you've got the one little horn replacing three of the horns, and the little horns has eyes that, like a man's eyes, and a mouth that brags. Okay, now what have we got here? My goodness, we've got symbolism coming out of our ears, don't we? Well, out of our horns. if the 10 kings are specifically 10 kings, now listen to me real close, and if they are successive kings of a kingdom, how can three of them be plucked out at the same time? Because there's never three kings of a kingdom, is there? Now, I personally think that instead of, and all the problem I've seen of if you believe it's the Roman Empire, you try to pick 10 Caesars. The problem is there's more than 10 Caesars. If you think it's the Persian period, you try to pick four Persian kings and you can't really do it, so you've got to go into the Seleucid Empire or the Ptolemaic Empire. If you think it's the Antichrist, I think it is that, but I think if you think it's the Pope, you got to start naming off certain popes. The problem is no 10 fits. I think 10 is probably symbolic of the fullness of the kings of these particular empires, and therefore when it speaks of three of them being ripped out, it's not so much speaking of three kings being killed as it is the power and authority of this little horn. Now, who is this little horn? What is his purpose? What is he doing here? Now, let me look again. Okay. Some want to make this little horn Antiochus Epiphanes, or Antiochus the Fourth. You ever heard of him? Write his name down. He is central in this whole argument. Antiochus. I think I have it written down here, don't I? Somewhere for you? Let me find where I have it written down, because I can't spell a thing either. I think it's A-N-T-I-O-C-H-U-S. Antiochus the Fourth, called Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, he is the one, if you believe this book is written in the Maccabean period, he is the one, the ruler of Syria, the Syrian-Babylonian part of Greek Empire, that tried to offer the pig on the altar in Jerusalem. That's the one. He tried to bring a statue of his god into the temple at Jerusalem. He is the one who tried to force the priest of Modin, which was the father of Judas Maccabeus, which is the one who had the successful revolt. And they see Antiochus Epiphanes as this little horn bragging great things, trying to, when it comes down a little bit further, let me pick it up real quick if I can. No, it's way over in the chapter. He's going to try to change the times and the laws. He's going to change the Jewish feast days. He's going to make them eat certain foods they're not supposed to. See, he tried to force all the Jews to eat pork, and these Jews physically rebelled instead of eating pork. Now, we're going to get to Antiochus Epiphanes in chapter 8. In chapter 8, the little horn of chapter 8 is Antiochus Epiphanes the Fourth. It's chapter 8, it's got to be, because the little horn is in the third kingdom, not the fourth. Now, this is very confusing. The seventh chapter of the little horn is in the fourth kingdom. In the eighth chapter, the little horn is in the third kingdom. Now, in the eighth chapter, it is Antiochus Epiphanes the Fourth. in the third chapter, I believe it's the Antichrist. Now, the reason that they're going to say it's this Antiochus Epiphanes in both chapters is they don't want the fourth kingdom to be Rome. Because you see, if you don't believe in predictive prophecy, if this was written in 165 A.D., the Roman Empire hasn't come yet. And if you can't have a supernatural kind of revelation, it can't be the Roman Empire. You see what I'm saying? So they've got to make it what's current in their day, which is this Seleucid Empire. Now, another reason that these commentators say this is, it just seems dumb to me that one-fourth of Alexander's empire can even be in the same list as countries like Babylon, Medo-Persian. You see, have you ever taken a test where it says, circle the thing that doesn't fit, and it'll have pennies, quarters, dollars, and apricots. And you want to search for apricots. Well, that's the way this thing fits. How about Babylon, Medo-Persian, Greek, and Roman? Friends, the little bitty country of the Seleucid Empire doesn't fit in that list, you see? Because these are world empires, huge kind of reign. Seleucid was only one part of one little kingdom. So I don't think it fits there at all. But it's presupposition based on a fear of predictive prophecy and based on a trying to identify chapter 8 with chapter 7, which it just won't do. Now, is this getting too involved? This thing is a ball of worms. I won't tell you. I thought I was doing a course in botany or something or some kind of medical deal. I had four toes and three wings and two heads and one horn all in the same chapter. So it's tough, and the only way to go through it is like this, I'm afraid. So listen as best you can. You try to grasp the history that I'm saying along with taking notes, because it'll help you. In chapter 8, the same kind of ball of wax, and chapter 9 and all. So it'll start fitting better to you as you come next week and the next week. Because after you hear something over and over, you start remembering it and putting it together. Okay, now, the little one pulls up three of the other ones and just completely eradicates them. Now, verse 9 completely changes the scene. We got four successive kingdoms symbolized by beasts. And now, suddenly, pow, scene changes. Man, just like his dream completely switched. And instead of seeing this gigantic ocean where beasts are coming out of, he sees the heavenly court. Friend, we're in heaven now, and we're going to see what happens. Now, verse 9. I was looking until thrones were set up. Now, King James has thrones were cast down. This is very difficult because the word can be translated cast down. Hebrew is a language of tenses, kind of like Greek is. And it's very hard because Hebrew words can mean entirely different things by being in different tenses. In Greek, when the tense changes, it speaks of kind of action or that kind of thing. It's the same word. You always translate it the same way. But in Hebrew, by changing the tense, you change the entire meaning. One meaning of this Hebrew word is cast down, but it is not the form that appears here, because this is not Hebrew. This is still Aramaic. Aramaic is still going to go until through chapter 7. So, this word should be translated set up, arranged. Now, what we got is not somebody throwing around thrones. We've got somebody arranging thrones, setting them in a circle or something like that. Now, the throne is plural. We don't have one big throne and God on it. We've got a bunch of thrones. Now, who are these thrones for? Of course, one is for the person that's called the Ancient of Days. Who are the other thrones for? There's been a kind of an argument through history. I think there's two possible explanations. I'm going to give you the references, please. Number one, and I don't know if I have this down or not. I do not. So under 13 of Word and Phrase Study, put these down, please. Angels, the heavenly hosts, the divine counsel, all that kind of thing. And a biblical reference would be Psalms 89, 7 and 8. The heavenly host. That's why God is called the Lord of hosts, the angels or the heavenly counsel. Now, the other one, I think, would be the saints. The saints. Now, I'm not talking about just Jews. I'm talking about the saints of God, Old Testament, New. And here's the references. Luke 22, 30. 1 Corinthians 6, 2. And Revelation 24, 20, verse 4. Okay, it could be the saints, it could be angels, it could be we don't know who. Now, And the Ancient of Days took his seat. Now, does your translation have the Ancient of Days? Definite article? What translation, Ernie? Okay, that's mine. Who has the? What about Living Bible? Has the? Well, mine has it too. I don't know why they do this. In verses 13 and 22, where this name is mentioned again, there is the definite article. The definite article does not appear in verse 9. Now, Hebrew is just like Greek. If the definite article does not appear, it's not speaking of a specific thing, it's speaking of the quality of the thing. So, the thing is magnified. This should not be capitalized here, I don't think. In 13 and 22, it should be capitalized, but in 9, it is describing the character of the one. You could translate it, the eternal one, the everlasting one, the Ancient of Days, descriptive. He is the one who has lived forever. He is the one who is very old. And we see that described here. Listen, his clothes were white as snow. His hair was like wool. Now, real question I want you to ask. I want you to think about it before you answer me. And we'll vote on it. Is this a physical description of God? Is this a physical description of God? All who say yes. Okay, all who say no. Okay, why? Why is it not? Excuse me? Okay. Is the symbolism here to express God? Is God the Ancient of Days symbolically? Yes. Yes. We're trying to describe the judgment day. How are we going to describe the judgment day? How are we going to describe a judgment by a spiritual being to human beings? The reason we talk about God as his right arm is not shortened. The reason we talk about God is riding on chariots. The reason we talk about God is getting angry. The reason we talk about God is repenting. The reason we talk about God is seeing Moses seeing God's hind part is because we can't talk about God except by understanding something we can relate to. It sounds funny, the Spirit was hovering over the judgment, you know. So they picture God as how any Oriental would picture God because age was revered in Oriental people, right? A man with pure white hair, a man in white raiment. These are symbols of purity, symbols of reverence, symbols of age. So, no, it's not a description of God, for God is a spirit. He does not have a body. The only part of the Trinity that has a body is Jesus Christ. That's why a lady called me today, watched our television show. She said, I don't understand about this deal about Jesus sitting on the right hand of God. I said, well, I understand that as a symbol of Jesus Christ's authority, not as a symbol of God sitting on the throne and Jesus Christ sitting next to him. I think when we get to heaven, we're going to see Jesus Christ, and he will be the physical embodiment of all that God is. Now, that seems to be, to me, Hebrews 1:1-3, and other things. I think Jesus is the only part of God that has a corporal existence, okay? And so here, I think that's what he's talking about. Now, notice the idea of flames, blaze of flames, burning fire, river of fire. You see all that in the last part of 9 and 10? Why is deity often accompanied with fire? Purification, okay. Anything else? Judgment? How about radiance? You ever looking at the sun? It just dazzles you. You can't even look at it. Well, that's the way deity was. Awful, different, holy, set apart. So every time God appears in the Old Testament, he appears with some kind of light, doesn't he? You got the transfiguration. You got the lightning on Mount Sinai. You got the angel of the Lord ascending in the fire on the altar in Samuel. On and on, you got God and light identified. Now, what are the wheels about? The wheels, the last part of verse 9. Its wheels were of a burning fire. What is that talking about? When I say wheels, what prophet do you immediately think of? Ezekiel. Ezekiel 1, 15 through 28. Now, many of the ancient thrones had large kinds of chariot wheels on the side of the throne. Why? What would that symbolize to you if I had, if my desk had two big wagon wheels on each side, what would that symbolize to you? If you say cowboy ship? No. How about omnipresence? the ability to move fast in any direction. That's what the wheels were in Ezekiel, were they not? Wheels that turned every way at the same time with eyes on them. The symbol of omnipresence as well as omniscience. Okay. I think it's just a regular way of saying that God's throne was there, but God's throne was like a chariot. He could be where he wanted to, you see. It's that symbol of being God being where he wanted to. Not controlled, limited by one place. Now, notice where it talks about thousands of thousands in verse 10 and myriads upon myriads. Who are we talking about? Thousands of thousands, myriads of myriads. Who are we talking about? Two possibilities, right? What are they? Saints and who else? Angels. That's probably, it's got to be one or the other. Is there any way to know? No. Because of the symbolism over here in verse 13 about all the languages and all the peoples, I probably would make it the saints. The saints of God, Old Testament, New. Now, last part of verse 10, very interesting concept. Now listen, if you're kind of going to sleep, wake up right now for a minute. The books were opened. What books? What books are we talking about? I didn't put enough references here. You see the references I gave you? The ones from Revelation 20. I want you to turn to Revelation 20, 15. Revelation 20. Turn there for me real quick. I'm going to read verse 12, I think. Yep. Revelation 20, 12. And I'm going to try, when you read that with me, try to find how many books are spoken about. How many books? And I saw the dead, great and small, standing before the throne. And the books were opened. And another book was opened, which is the book of life, and the dead were judged from the things that were written in the books according to their deeds. How many books are we talking about? At least two, right? One of them, which is going to be called the book of life, and one, which the Old Testament would call the book of remembrances. One is a list of names of those that are saved. One is a list of deeds of every man's life. Now, I'll try to prove that in many more scriptures. Notice, number one, the book of life, if you please. The book of life can be found, and write these down because you don't have time to look at it right now. Exodus 32, 32. You've got Luke 10, 20. But add to me, if you would there, please, right between Exodus and Luke in your account, add Psalm 69, 28. Another very good reference for this. Now, make a mark between Luke and Isaiah. Just make a little dash because we're going to skip from the book of life, the book of salvation, to the book of remembrances, or the book of deeds, the book of judgment. And you see the Isaiah passage there, and you see the Malachi passage. But please add Psalm 56, 8, and Psalms 139, 16. Psalms 56, 8, and Psalms 139, 15. When you get home, look up there and see if you can find those two books and those references. See if you can find the book of life, and the book of deeds are remembrances. Okay? Very interesting concept in the Word of God. Now, going to last part of verse 11 where it talks about the beast was slain and its body was destroyed. Okay? Now, I want you to notice the little horn is what Daniel is going to ask about. Who's the little horn? What's he doing? But I want you to notice in verse 11, the little horn is not slain. What's slain? The beast. Now, the beast represents what? The kingdom. The little horn represents one king. So the whole kingdom is going to be destroyed. Totally destroyed. Now, let me see real quick. I want to ask a question right here in verse 11. This is a very difficult question. You try to think of me and see what you think the problem is. Daniel has a vision. If I'm right, and the little horn refers to the Antichrist that's one day going to come, if the fourth kingdom is the Roman Empire, why does the Bible not see the kingdom from the Roman Empire to the kingdom in the day the Antichrist will come? What happened to South America and China and Japan and the United States and Russia and Czechoslovakia? Where are all those kingdoms in the Bible? Why are they left out? Why does Daniel see only four kingdoms? Tough question, isn't it? Yeah, but even if Daniel wrote them, he knew Cyrus, you know, in his lifetime, but he didn't know Alexander the Great. He didn't know the Romans, so it was even beyond him then, two kingdoms beyond him. So two of them were prophecy anyway. Why didn't God tell him about the rest of them? I think it does. I've talked to you about I think 50 times. I feel like I'm boring you by telling you again, but if I am, just wink at me and I'll quit. The Old Testament saw the present evil age and the coming messianic age, the day of the Lord. It saw just two ages, right? Evil age, coming of the Lord, judgment, messianic age, two ages. Now, I don't think that the Old Testament has many references to the second coming, but has beaucoup references to the first coming. For the Jew thought that it was going to stop one thing and the kingdom was going to come. But what happened? We live in what's called the overlapping, the latter days. From when Jesus was born till Jesus comes again, these kingdoms, we're living in the midst of having God in our hearts, but sin in our lives. We live in the midst of this being the kingdom of God and the kingdom of this world. We live in an overlapping. The Jews didn't see that, you see? And all these kingdoms we know are in this overlapping, right? I believe that when Daniel saw the Roman Empire and the coming of the one called the Ancient of Days and the Son of Man, I think it's a funny fact that the kingdom of God was in one sense set up in the Roman Empire's day. Now, it wasn't consummated, it's not fulfilled, it's not complete, and I think the little horn is talking about the second coming, if you please. But the Jews didn't see that, and God didn't reveal it to Daniel. Another point of view. Every government is almost for sure based on the same type of government as Rome. You know, many of our laws are based on Roman law, aren't they, Gary? Roman law is a place we usually start. We usually don't go back to Moses or Hammurabi. We usually start with Rome. In a real sense, the pattern of the kingdoms of the world are Roman, you know? Now, of course, maybe China's not, but as soon as they hit our culture, they begin to come westernized and like that. So I don't know exactly why, but I think it's this overlapping problem that the Jews didn't see. Now, you see where it talks about, if it's Antiochus Epiphanes, which some say it is, many kings came after him. So it wasn't destroyed when he was alive, the kingdom he had. So I don't think it could be him at all. I think that's a completely false statement. Now, you see where it says in verse 12, an extension of life was granted to them for an appointed period of time. Now, this is not talking about the little horn and the last beast. It's talking about the three previous beasts, aren't they? Right? Verse 12 is talking about the first three beasts. Now, what does it mean they weren't killed right then, but their life was extended for an appointed period of time? Could it be that this fourth kingdom was completely annihilated, completely off the map, completely gone, but the other three kingdoms, the power was taken away from them, although they exist as a national entity? Does that sound good? Huh? Iran? What would the other one be? Greece? Right? What would the other one be? Would they be the same area as Iran? I think that's probably what it's talking about. These countries haven't been annihilated, but was the fourth one just about gone? When Rome fell, boy, she fell, didn't she? And although there's still the national things there, like Italy, that's the only thing I can think of, is some kind of national kind of existence continued. Now, in verse 13, the scene is going to change radically again. We're still in heaven, but something happens. God comes to the Ancient of Days, is sitting on the throne, and all of a sudden something happens. Behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a Son of Man. Mine has it capitalized. I think that's interpretive right here. I'm not sure it should be capitalized as a title yet. One like a Son of Man was coming. Now, I want to do two things here, and I know it's getting late. Dadgum. Number one, the deity idea comes from the clouds of heaven. Who rides on the clouds of heaven? How many references do I give you? Okay, let me see. Let me add to that. On number 21, word study, clouds of heaven, add Revelation 1. Is it 3 or 7? Dad, gone. Revelation 1, 7. Add that to that. The clouds of heaven is an expression all through the New Testament of Jesus Christ. He ascended back to heaven how? Until the clouds caught him out of their sight. He's coming back again with the holy angels and on the clouds of heaven. Deity. Deity, bang. Next thing, not deity anymore, humanity. There's two words in Hebrew for man. One is the word Adam. It's everywhere except the first chapter of Genesis translated man. In Genesis 1 through 3, I guess, it's the proper name of Adam. But it's the Hebrew word Adam. It means man. It means man like Psalms 8, Psalms 10, Ezekiel. When it says son of man in Ezekiel, it's the word Adam. When in Psalms 8 it speaks about the greatness of man, it's Adam. In Psalms 10, it's Adam. It's not Adam here. It's another word. And it should probably be Nosh or Noosh. Now, this word, it's in verse 13, speaks of man in his frailty, in his weakness, in his ability to get sick and die. Therefore, this is not the title like in Ezekiel, the son of man. Now, Ezekiel is speaking of mankind. And here, I think it's speaking of mankind too. Notice, it doesn't say the son of man was coming. It says one like a son of man. I think it's just saying one like a human was coming. A man was coming in contradistinction from these terrible beasts. Now, the man is going to be the fifth kingdom, isn't he? This one like the Son of Man. Now, this is Aramaic, not Hebrew. If it was Hebrew, it would be maybe a title. This is Aramaic, and Aramaic doesn't have a definite article. So, this could be a human king. I do not think it's a title for Jesus Christ here. I think it seems deity and humanity combined, which is, of course, what? The incarnation idea of Jesus Christ. This is not a title for him. It's two ways to describe him. Deity, God, and man comes before the Ancient of Days. Notice what happens. I need to go off to something else just for a minute. Some have said that this idea of the Son of Man, who is this Son of Man? Now, if you'll look at verses 18, 22, and 27, you'll see that every one of those says, and the kingdom was given to who? 18, 22, 27. Saints, plural, right?